he said. "Are you Norman Chaney?" I asked. "Uh-huh," he said again. He was over 6 feet tall, even though he stooped slightly, one shoulder noticeably higher than the other. I swung the crowbar, aiming for the side of his head, but Chaney reared back, and the tip of the bar connected with the bridge of his nose. There was a splintery crack as he staggered back, blood falling in a sheet down over his chin. He raised his hands to his face and wetly said, "The fuck?" Stepping into the house, I swung the crowbar again, but Chaney easily blocked it with his meaty left arm, then swung at me with his right, batting me in the shoulder with a fist. It didn't hurt, but it knocked me off balance for a moment, and Chaney charged, grabbing me by my tracksuit in both fists, shoving me up against a wall. Something, probably a coat hook, jabbed me high up in my back. Warm blood was spraying from Chaney's nose, hitting me in the face. Some memory, probably from an Ian Fleming novel, went through my panicked mind, and I raised my right foot, bringing my heavy boot down hard on Chaney's instep. Chaney grunted and loosened his grip, and I pushed forward as he stumbled backward, both of us falling after a few steps, me landing on top of him, hard, hearing something snap. Chaney's face contorted, and his mouth opened and closed like a fish pulled from the water. I pushed myself off his body, then put a knee on his chest and leaned on top of him again. He struggled to breathe, and I put my gloved hands around his thick neck and squeezed, pressing as hard as I could with my thumbs. He tried to pull my hands loose, but he was already weakening. I closed my eyes and kept squeezing. After about a minute, or it might have been longer, I stopped and rolled off to the side, breathing heavily and aware that my mouth was salty and thick with blood. I ran my tongue around my teeth, but it was the tip of my tongue that was ragged and painful. I must have bit it during the fight. Blood was filling my mouth, and I swallowed it. It seemed a bad idea to spit a mouthful of my own blood onto the scene of a crime, even though I knew I'd probably left all sorts of DNA traces already. Crouching in front of Chaney, and without directly looking at him, I felt for a pulse in both his neck and his wrist. There was none. I stood, the world wobbling around me for a moment, then bent to pick up the crowbar. I had decided earlier that I would need to go through the house, take a few valuables after Chaney was dead, but I didn't know if I had it in me. I just wanted to be back in the car, heading as far away from what had just happened as possible. I was about to turn when movement from the corner of my eye made me look across the foyer toward the open-plan living room with floor-to-ceiling windows. A ginger cat was making its way slowly toward me, its unclipped nails clicking on the hardwood floor. The cat stopped and sniffed at Chaney's body, then looked again at me and meowed loudly, taking 2 steps closer, then flopping onto its side and stretching out to show its white, tufted stomach. A wave of almost paralyzing cold swept through my body, a premonition that for the rest of my life this one image, this cat asking for love while its owner lay murdered on the floor, would haunt me forever. Without thinking, I bent down and scooped up the cat, bringing it with me out to my car and driving away. The snow had picked up and had now begun to stick to the roads. I drove slowly, reversing my route back through Tick Hill's town center, then picking up the highway that would lead me through the White Mountains and south to Massachusetts. My movements in the car felt slow and deliberate, and even the car itself felt like it was moving through air that had turned into something close to solid. Time had slowed down, and everything was suffused with a sense of unreality. I looked down at the passenger seat where I'd put the docile cat. Some part of my brain was yelling that you never take anything from the scene of a crime, telling me I'd just signed my death warrant. But I kept driving. The cat was now looking up toward the window at the snowflakes flying by the car. There was no collar. I reached a hand out and rubbed the cat along its spine. It was thinner than I thought, most of its bulk coming from its thick orange fur. I thought I could detect a tiny purr vibrating through my fingertips. Once I was through the mountains and my mind had started to clear a little, I made the decision that I would pull over into some random town, look for a store or an inn, someplace with an unlocked door, and slide the cat inside. He or she would be found and taken to a shelter. There was a risk, a huge risk, that someone would see me, but I had to try. I should never have taken the cat, and I couldn't even remember now why I had done it. But now that the cat was in the car, I couldn't bring myself to simply push it out onto the side of the road. That would be the prudent thing to do, but the cat's chances of survival would be so slim. I kept driving, and somewhere in southern New Hampshire, the cat put its head down and went to sleep. I hadn't pulled over in any random town, and I suddenly knew that I wasn't going to. When I arrived back in Beacon Hill and found a parking spot right in front of my building, the cat was still with me. I scooped it up and took it upstairs. It was 10:30 in the morning. While the cat padded around my small apartment, sniffing and rubbing its cheek along every piece of furniture, I stripped off all my clothes and put them, along with the crowbar, into a heavy-duty garbage bag. Then I showered, soaping up and rinsing off at least 3 times until the hot water began to run out. In my original plan for the day, I was going to leave Cheney's house, then drive slightly north to a used bookstore I knew that was in an old refurbished barn. I'd been there multiple times and in the past had had luck finding rare editions of crime novels. If for some reason I wound up being a suspect in Cheney's death, if my car had been spotted by someone, then at least I'd have had some reason for being in New Hampshire on that particular Monday. It was a very thin alibi, but it was better than nothing. I suppose that now I could say that I was planning on driving to a favorite bookstore, but turned back because of the snow. Of course, none of that would explain the presence of a murdered man's cat in my apartment, a cat that was now rubbing its chin up against my ankle. I found a can of tuna, tipped it into a bowl, then filled a second bowl with water. I also found the lid from a cardboard box and scattered some dirt from one of my spider plants into it, hoping it would work as a litter box. While the cat ate, I went onto my computer and did a Google search to find out how to know if a cat was male or female. After some poking around, I decided that the cat was male. I spent the day inside with him, at one point both of us sleeping together on the sofa, the cat down by my feet. Toward nightfall, he'd found his way onto the bed, and he curled up on my current book, a paperback copy of Rex Stout's Too Many Cooks. I named the cat Nero. 1 month later, 1 month after I had left Norman Cheney's corpse in Tick Hill, New Hampshire, 2 things were clear. One, the police weren't coming for me. Even though I hadn't gone online to look up anything about the Cheney murder case, I felt deep in my bones that I'd gotten away with it. The second realization was that Nero, who'd taken to his new home pretty happily, needed more people around him. I was often gone for 12 hours at a time, and when I returned home, Nero was right at the door, desperate for affection. Mary Ann, my downstairs neighbor, told me she could hear him crying during the day. I was beginning to think that Nero would make an excellent store cat at Old Devil's. Chapter 13. Being an avid mystery reader as an adolescent does not prepare you for real life. I truly imagined that my adult existence would be far more book-like than it turned out to be. I thought, for example, that there would be several moments in which I got into a cab to follow someone. I thought I'd attend far more readings of someone's will, and that I'd need to know how to pick a lock, and that any time I went on vacation, especially to old creaky inns or rented lake houses, something mysterious would happen. I thought train rides would inevitably involve a murder, that sinister occurrences would plague wedding weekends, and that old friends would constantly be getting in touch to ask for help, to tell me that their lives were in danger. I even thought quicksand would be an issue. I was prepared for all this in the same way that I wasn't prepared for the soul-crushing minutiae of life. The bills, the food preparation. The slow, dawning realization that adults live in uninteresting bubbles of their own making. Life is neither mysterious nor adventurous. Of course, I came to these conclusions before I became a murderer. Not that my criminal career satisfied the fantasy life I had as a kid. In my fantasies, I was never the murderer. I was the good guy, the detective, amateur, usually, who solved the crime. I was never the villain. Another skill set I thought I'd utilize more in my adult years was the ability to follow someone, and conversely, the ability to know when I was being followed. Again, these things never really came up. But on that Saturday night, after closing up Old Devils, I walked across the Boston Common, wind cutting through my clothes, and wound up at the bar at Jacob Wirth, drinking German beer and eating Wiener Schnitzel. It was the middle of February, but there were still Christmas lights strung up along the high ceilings of the beer hall, and somehow this place made me feel okay about eating alone. That was how I judged restaurants near me. There were the ones that made you feel lonely when you ate alone, like some of the higher-end haunts that clutter Back Bay. And then there were those places, Jacob Wirth, a restaurant called Stoddard's, that were boisterous enough and dark enough that being alone didn't seem to matter so much. It was when I left Jacob Wirth and began the cold walk home that I felt sure I was being watched. Maybe I really have read too many books, but I felt it in my neck, an almost physical sensation that eyes were on me. I turned back, scanned the heavily bundled residents and tourists, but saw no one who seemed suspicious. But the feeling continued all the way to Charles Street, and when I turned up Revere toward my apartment, I looked back and saw a man, in the hazy light of the gas lamps, walking slowly across the intersection, his gaze in my direction, his face in shadow. The only distinguishing characteristic that I could make out was that he wore a hat, something with a narrow brim. He kept walking, a slow, rolling gait, and for a moment I almost considered turning around to confront him. But then he disappeared behind a building, and I changed my mind. Everyone walking along Charles Street glances up the residential side streets, especially in wintertime when they are at their prettiest. When I was inside, I thought some more about the man on the street and decided that I was being paranoid. No one was literally following me. But that didn't mean that I wasn't being watched somehow, that I wasn't being toyed with. Ever since Gwen Mulvey had arrived at Old Devils asking me about the list of perfect murders, I'd been thinking about my shadow, the man, I always thought of him as a man, whom I'd met when he answered an anonymous message about strangers on a train, the man who killed Eric Atwell for me, the man who wanted Norman Chaney dead. What if he'd figured out who I was? It wouldn't have been too hard. Maybe he found me by doing some research into Eric Atwell. If he'd done just a little looking, he would have found out about Claire's car accident and the husband left behind, a man who worked at a mystery bookstore. Not only that, but a man who had once published a blog post about his 8 favorite perfect murders, one of them being strangers on a train. It would have been easy to find me. And once he did, then what? Maybe he'd enjoyed killing Eric Atwell and he wanted to keep on doing it. What if he decided to use my list as a blueprint for further murders? It would be a way to get my attention. It had, hadn't it? Was it all some kind of game? The more I thought about it, the more I became convinced that Charlie, who'd staged the ABC murders and the train murder from Double Indemnity and probably scared Elaine Johnson to death up in Rockland, Maine, was the same man who'd shot Eric Atwell for me. He knew me, and his actions had brought the FBI to my door. Maybe that was his intention as well. Charlie, what is it that you want? I thought some more about strangers on a train. The book wasn't about the people who were murdered. It was about Bruno and Guy, the murderers and their relationship with each other. Maybe whoever I contacted through that website felt as though we were in a relationship as well. I remembered the commenter on my blog post, Dr. Shepherd. It was clear he wanted to know me and that he wanted me to know him. My cell phone rang. I looked and saw it was Gwen. "Hello," I said.
"Sorry I'm calling you so late. Were you up?"
"It's fine," I said. "I'm up."
"Great. A couple of things. I did some more poking around in the case of Elaine Johnson, the heart attack victim."
"Right."
"I spoke with a police detective who attended the scene, and she told me that the house was absolutely packed with books."
"I'm not surprised." Gwen paused, then said,
"I have a request of you. I know it's strange, but I think it would be helpful. I'm driving to Rockland tomorrow afternoon. Could you come with me?"
"I suppose I could," I said, "but I'm not sure I'd be any help. What would I be able to see that you wouldn't be able to?"
"I've already thought about this," Gwen said. "Maybe you'd see nothing, but maybe you'd see a lot. You knew her. I'm not sure it would be helpful, but I don't think it could hurt. Does that make any sense to you?"
"A little bit," I said.
"So you'll come?"
"Sure, I guess. When are you leaving?"
"Excellent. I have to be here in New Haven all morning, and then I thought I could leave around noon. I'll swing through Boston and pick you up 1:30-ish, and we'll get to Rockland about 5 in the afternoon. Will that work?"
"Okay," I said. "I can get coverage at the store. Will we be there overnight?"
"I hadn't even thought of that. I just decided 5 minutes ago to make this trip."
She thought for a moment.
"Let's plan on spending the night. The detective said she'd meet us there at 5, but we might want to take more than one look at the house, and there might be other witnesses I can interview the next day. Is an overnight okay?"
"Sure," I said.
"Perfect. I'll text you when I'm leaving New Haven. Should I pick you up at the store or at your apartment?"
I told her I'd be at the store, and we ended the call. I stood for a moment, then went and grabbed a beer from the fridge. I didn't really know why Gwen wanted me to come along with her to Elaine Johnson's house. She was grasping at straws. Maybe she was ambitious and thought I'd help her take down a serial killer. Maybe she wanted me there because she was hoping I'd tip my hand, that confronted with a crime scene, I'd give myself away. Of course, her impulse was correct. Elaine Johnson was one of the murderers on the list. The same man, my shadow, who killed Eric Atwell, had decided to keep killing people and to use my list. And he was reaching out to me. That was made clear by his choosing Elaine as one of the victims. But how exactly did he know about her? Know that she used to frequent the bookstore? How close was he to me? I didn't have the answers to those questions, but I did know in my gut that Gwen Mulvey was going to figure it out. She'd put it all together so far, and she was going to continue to put it together. And it was going to lead back to me, to the murder of Eric Atwell, and to what I'd done to Norman Chaney in New Hampshire. She was going to find me, and that meant I needed to find my shadow first. I needed to beat her to it. Chapter 14. The next day I woke early, packed an overnight bag, and went to Old Devil's. I hadn't slept well. I'd been thinking about him, of course. I realized that I need to decide on a formal name for this man. I'd always thought of him as my shadow, but that sounds a little too much like a comic book character. I think instead I'll go with Charlie, the name that Gwen and I came up with together. Charlie works. After I unlocked the store's front door, Nero came bounding through his cat door that led to the half-basement. It was where he sometimes slept, down near the furnace, but he never spent time there if people were around. He dropped and lolled in front of me, and I bent and rubbed his chest and under his chin. I thought there might be a point in my life when Nero would stretch out to get attention and I wouldn't think of Norman Chaney's bloodied corpse. But it hadn't happened yet. I went to the store computer and checked emails, then wrote a quick one to Brandon, asking if he'd be willing to close up the shop after his afternoon shift.
I knew he'd do it, but I just wanted to make sure. It was Sunday morning, early, so I didn't expect an email back anytime soon. I drank coffee and thought some more about my plan for that morning. I figured that by 9 o'clock, or maybe even 8:30, it would be a decent time to call Marty Kingship, a former police officer I know who was now working part-time as a security consultant for one of the big downtown hotels. I met Marty 3 years ago when he came into the store during a Dennis Lehane signing. He stayed long after Lehane left, asking me questions about crime novels, saying that he was thinking of writing one himself since he'd been on the force. Before he left that night, he asked me if I wanted to grab a drink with him sometime. I told him I would and was surprised when he immediately suggested a place and a time. A bar called Marliav on the other side of the park on the next Thursday night at 8. It was a place I'd never been, the Marliav, tucked away on a side street near Downtown Crossing. The entrance was a narrow doorway that led to a tile-floored bar that looked more like a French bistro than the type of place an ex-cop would like to drink. Marty Kingship was at the long bar talking to one of the bartenders. He almost looked surprised when I grabbed the seat next to him, as though he'd forgotten arranging our meeting. "You came," he said. "Sure." "What are you having?" "I'm having a Miller Lite, but Robert here," he indicated the bartender, "tells me that I have terrible taste." I ordered a Hefeweizen. Marty got another beer and ordered some food, escargot, and a plate of meatball sliders. I've never been good at making friends. Sometimes I blame it on the fact that I am an only child and that neither of my parents, excepting my father when he was drunk, was particularly sociable. But I think it goes deeper than that, to an inability to make genuine connections with people. The longer I interact with someone, the more distant I begin to feel from them. I can feel an enormous amount of affection for an elderly German tourist who visits my store for 10 minutes and buys a used copy of a Simon Brett novel. But whenever I begin to truly get to know people, it's as though they start to dim, as though they are behind a glass partition that gets thicker and thicker. The more I learn about them, the harder they are to see and hear in any meaningful way. There are exceptions. Claire, for one. My best friend in junior high, Lawrence Thibault, who moved to somewhere in Brazil at the end of 8th grade. And characters in books, of course. And poets. The more I learn about them, the more I like them. Marty, when I first met him, was looking for friends, and for a while I tried to fill that role. He'd been a police officer in Western Mass, but had quit shortly after his kids had left the house and his wife had filed for divorce. He'd moved into a one-bedroom condo near Dudley Square and considered himself semi-retired, even though he did do the occasional security work, and even though he was outlining a novel that I was pretty sure he would never write. He was a funny guy. Also, he was much smarter than he looked with his crew cut and his broken nose and his pear-shaped body. He easily read about 5 books a week. For a while, he'd come into the bookstore near closing time, stock up on new titles, then we'd go somewhere for a drink. He always had a story or a funny anecdote, and there was never any silence when we were together. At first, it worked, but like most of my relationships, after a time, I felt that wall come up between us. It was as though we'd hit the natural plateau of our friendship, and it was never going to expand. These days, we usually only get together for a drink around Christmas time. I didn't know if Marty could help me, but I thought it was worth a try. He'd have the time and he'd have the resources to find out information about Norman Chaney. It was a risk, but one that I needed to take. Charlie, whoever he was, had wanted Norman Chaney to die. And I also knew that he wanted someone else to do it, which meant that he would have been a suspect in the killing. At 9, I called Marty. "Hey, stranger," he said. "Did I wake you?" "Nah, just got out of the shower. Spent about 20 goddamn minutes trying to get the old sliver of soap to stick to my new bar. I must have bought a new brand and they wouldn't keep together at all. It's not like one was green and one was brown or something. They were pretty much the same color and they wanted nothing to do with each other. I'm sure that's why you called, to find out about my shower, right? No, but that was a great story. You got a lot going on in your life, huh? I do, actually. Cindy's coming and staying here for spring break. I'm not deluded. She's interested in some guy at BU, but still, something to look forward to. Cindy was Marty's daughter, the only member of the family with whom he still had regular contact. That's good news, Marty. Look, I actually have a favor to ask from you. Oh, yeah? If it's something you can't do or don't feel right about, just tell me. It's not going to be a big deal. You want me to kill someone? He said, and laughed. No, but I actually do want some information on someone who was killed. Is that something you can do as an ex-cop? What kind of information? This has to be just between us, I said. You can't tell anyone. Not a problem. You in trouble? No, I said. During the course of the phone conversation, I'd begun to realize that I would need some sort of reason for what I was asking. I quickly decided on a twisted version of the truth. The FBI got in contact with me over an old homicide case, a man from New Hampshire who was murdered about 4 years ago, Norman Chaney, Chaney. They didn't tell me everything, but apparently he had a lot of books from the store and they think there might be some connection. What kind of connection? They wouldn't tell me, exactly. I'm feeling thrown by this whole thing, and I was wondering if you could look into it for me, find out something about this guy. I feel like maybe they're not telling me the whole story, that it might have something to do with Claire or something. I can make some calls, sure, Marty said, sounding a little confused. It's probably nothing, Mal. Periodically, someone will be handed a cold case and they find some avenue that wasn't fully investigated, like where he got his books from, and they decide to check it out. It's grasping at straws. You said it was the FBI came to see you? Yeah, that's strange, isn't it? Don't worry about it. I'll make some calls. I'm sure it's nothing. Thanks so much, Marty. What else is going on with you? Not too much. Buying books, selling books. Let's grab a beer soon. I'll call you when I get information on this Donald Chaney and we can meet. Norman Chaney. Right. Norman Chaney. Yeah, let's do that, I said. Grab a drink. I hung up the phone, realizing only after I'd done so that my shoulders were rigid and my jaw ached. Norman Chaney had been a name I'd been trying to forget for years. Just saying it out loud had physically changed me. Again, I wondered if I'd made a mistake by bringing Marty into this, but I needed to know who wanted Chaney dead. I rolled my shoulders, loosening them, just as Emily came through the door, unwinding a long scarf from around her neck. It was opening time, and I turned all the lights on in the store, went and put the open sign in the front door. There was a stack of new arrivals in the back that needed to be shelved, and after Emily had shed all her outerwear, the two of us got to work, mostly in silence. When we did talk, I noticed that her voice was slightly hoarse, as though she were coming down with a cold, or else she'd talked too much the night before. I remembered that she had plans. Still, it was hard to imagine Emily talking too much to anyone. It was hard to imagine Emily having plans. What's new with you these days? I asked her. What do you mean? She said. Nothing, really. I was curious if anything had changed in your life. You still living in Cambridge? You seeing anyone? She said, and I waited for more. Seen any good movies? I said, just to give her an out after the silence lasted an uncomfortable level of time. I saw Under the Skin, she said. Oh, yeah. Was that the one with Scarlett Johansson as the alien? Exactly. How was it? Really great. Good to know, I said, and decided to not ask her any more questions. I never had children, so I'll never know what it's like to have a suddenly silent teenager, but sometimes I felt like that was my relationship with Emily. We went back to shelving books, and I found myself thinking about my conversation with Marty. Maybe it had been a mistake to ask him to look at Norman Chaney, but it felt like something I had to do. Chaney was my link to Charlie. Well, also Elaine Johnson, I suppose, but he must have picked her because he knew I knew her. And if I assumed that the other murders were more or less random, then the murder that would lead me to his identity was Norman Chaney. He wanted Chaney dead, and if I found out why, I'd find Charlie. Around noon, my phone buzzed. It was Gwen, texting to let me know she was on her way. I told Emily that I was leaving early that day, but Brandon was closing up, and I also told her that there was a possibility she would have to open the store herself the following morning. Both Brandon and Emily had their own keys to Old Devils. If she was curious about where I was going, she didn't show it. Around 1, I began to keep an eye on the front door with its view out to Berry Street. My bag was packed with enough clothes and toiletries for a possible overnight stay. Despite the anxiety I was feeling about the situation and about what Gwen might discover, I was looking forward to the trip. I'd been feeling confined by Boston this winter. I was looking forward to the highway, to snowy vistas, to visiting a place I'd never been before. At 1:30, I poked my head out the front door and spotted Gwen pulling up in front of a hydrant in a beige Chevy Equinox. I said goodbye to Emily and headed out just as my cell phone began to ring. I saw Gwen's number on the screen, ignored it, and walked across the street to the passenger side door, knocking on the glass. She glanced in my direction, turned off the phone, and I got inside the car. It smelled new, and I wondered if it was a company car. I buckled up and put my small bag on the floor between my feet. "Hi," she said. "I did book us 2 rooms in Rockland, just in case. You have everything you need?" "I do," I said. She continued down Berry Street toward Storrow Drive. We were both quiet, and I decided to not speak first, not knowing if she was trying to concentrate on getting out of Boston. Once we hit 93 North, however, she thanked me for coming. "It'll be nice to get out of the city," I said. I turned and looked at her for the first time since I'd gotten into the car. She'd taken her coat off to drive and was wearing a cable-knit sweater and a pair of dark jeans. Her hands were correctly positioned on the steering wheel, 10 and 2, and she was studying the road as though she needed glasses. She was so intent that I was able to study her face a little. It was easier for me to see in profile, more distinctive with her slightly upturned nose, her dominant forehead, and smooth, pale skin, dusted here and there with a flush of red. Whenever I really look at people, I can't stop myself from picturing them as either very young or very old. With Gwen, I saw her as a 5-year-old, wide-eyed, chewing at her bottom lip, tucked in behind a parent's leg. Then I pictured her as an old woman, gray hair knotted down her back, her skin with that papery quality some old people get, but pretty with her large, intelligent eyes. There was something familiar about her as well, about the pale oval of her face, but I couldn't quite place it. "We're meeting Detective Cifelli at Elaine Johnson's house at 6 o'clock. Have you eaten lunch?" I told her I'd had a late breakfast, and we ended up stopping at a rest area around Kennebunk in Maine. There was a Burger King and a Popeyes. We each got burgers and coffee and ate quickly at a booth near a window. It was so bright outside, the sky cloudless and the ground covered with recently fallen snow, that we both squinted as we ate. After eating her burger, then popping the tab on the lid of her coffee, she said, "They arrested someone for the murder of Daniel Gonzalez last night." "Oh," I said, "the guy who was shot while walking his dog?" "Yeah, turns out he was also dealing MDMA to his students at the college he was working at, and he was shot by a rival drug dealer. I guess we got that wrong." "Still," I said. "Right, We've got many definites. The ABC murders are definite. The double indemnity murder is definite. And I feel pretty sure about what we're going to find at Elaine Johnson's house in Rockland.
Pretty sure we'll find what? I said.
Something. He'll have left something. He's theatrical, Charlie. Like it wasn't just enough for him to murder three people who had a connection between his names. He had to send a feather.
What feather? I said.
Oh, I forgot I didn't tell you. That's what arrived at the police stations after Robin Callahan and Ethan Bird and Jay Bradshaw all were killed. The police received an envelope containing a single bird feather. I shouldn't really have told you that since it's being withheld from the press, but I guess I trust you now.
That's good, I guess, I said.
And now you know what I mean by theatrical. That's why I think we'll find something at the scene of the crime. That, and because you knew her. Because whoever is following your list knows you. I don't mean that you know them. I mean, you might. But they know you. Charlie knows you. And I think we'll find something there, something to connect the crime to the list, something solid. I feel good about it. You still eating?
I realized that I'd been holding my half of a burger for the past 2 minutes.
Oh, sorry, I said, and took a large bite, even though I was no longer hungry. I knew everything Gwen was saying was correct, but it was still spooky to hear it from somewhere besides my own head. You can take it with you if you want, but we need to get back on the road. It's another 2 hours at least to Rockland.
Chapter 15. The inside of Elaine Johnson's house was pretty much as I'd imagined it, cluttered and dusty, books everywhere. The house was a cape with chipped gray paint on the outside. It was on a street about half a mile from Route 1, dwarfed by pine trees and almost unreachable because of the recent snowfall. Gwen parked the Equinox on the rutted street just behind the police car that was waiting for us, along with its occupant, Detective Laura Cifelli, a middle-aged woman with a round, pretty face, mostly obscured by the fur-lined hood of an enormous coat. It was dusk, a pale sun low in the horizon, our breath billowing in the sub-zero air. All three of us quickly said our hellos, then tramped through the snow to the front door where we stood for what felt like 5 minutes while Detective Cifelli retrieved the key from one of her pockets. There was a car in the driveway, one of those old boxy Lincolns, probably too big for the attached single-car garage. The detective told us once we were inside the house that the last she'd heard, the house was unclaimed property at this point, since Elaine Johnson had died without a will and with no immediate relatives.
Are there lights?
Gwen asked, and Detective Cifelli answered by hitting the nearest switch, which flooded the kitchen with harsh overhead lighting.
Utilities haven't been switched off yet, she said, and I guess they're keeping the heat on low so the pipes won't freeze.
I looked around the kitchen, surprised to see an open peanut butter jar on the tiled island, a knife stuck inside of it. I hadn't liked Elaine Johnson, but that didn't mean I rejoiced in her dying a lonely death.
Did any scene of crime officers file a report? Gwen asked. No, just the coroner. It was ruled a natural death. Heart attack. Since the body was taken out of here, no one's been back, far as I know.
Were you here?
I was. I got the call. The body was in the bedroom, halfway between her closet and the bed. I can show you, if you like. Corpse was here alone for over a week. I knew it was a dead body as soon as I got this far into the kitchen.
Ugh, sorry, Gwen said.
Who reported it? Neighbor across the street let us know her mail was piling up. Their mailboxes are side by side. When I came to check, the front door was unlocked, so I entered. Knew it was bad news right away.
Did the neighbor report anything else? Any suspicious activity in the neighborhood?
Not that I know of. We didn't consider this a suspicious death, though, so she was never asked. You're more than welcome to ask the neighbor yourself. Maybe tomorrow? You're spending the night?
We are, she said. I might want to talk with the coroner as well. It depends on what we find here in the house.
I'd been watching the two have this conversation, but I had begun to look around the kitchen as well. There were two shelving units above the back wall of the kitchen, probably meant for cooking supplies or food items, but Elaine had filled them with hardcover novels. I studied the spines. A lot of Elizabeth George novels and Anne Perry's, two of her favorites. But there were also a few books that I'd categorize as being in the romantic suspense category, veering toward romance, something Elaine Johnson had claimed to despise.
That would be fine, Detective Cifelli said, then added, So I'm happy to stay here with both of you, help you look around. I'm equally happy to leave you the key and let you have at it, just so long as you return it back to us in the morning.
You don't need to stay, Gwen said. You've done enough.
Great, then. I'll leave you here and you can swing by the police station any time in the morning.
Sounds good.
We both said our goodbyes and watched as the detective trudged back through the snow. Gwen turned toward me.
Ready?
She said. Sure. Should we have a plan of attack or just look around?
I thought you could focus on the books and I'd look at everything else.
Sure, I said. We stepped through into what had probably been intended as a dining room, and Gwen found the light switch that turned on a flickering chandelier. Every surface was covered with books, most just stacked haphazardly on the floor or on the rectangular dining room table.
Maybe I'll need some help on the books, I said.
You don't need to study them, but just look for anything out of the ordinary. I'm going to head upstairs to the bedroom.
I stayed in the dining room. It was hard to look at Elaine Johnson's collection of mystery novels without thinking about what they were worth. She had plenty of worthless books, stacks of mass markets in questionable condition. But I quickly identified a first edition of Patricia Cornwell's Postmortem and one of Michael Connelly's The Black Echo. I wondered what would happen to these books, then reminded myself that I wasn't here on business.
Malcolm?
It was Gwen, shouting down from the second floor.
Hey,
I shouted back.
Can you come up here?
I went up the stairs, also stacked with books along the edge of each step, and found Gwen in the bedroom, staring at a pair of handcuffs hanging from a nail. I pointed at them.
Don't touch anything, Gwen quickly said. I think we should get fingerprints.
There's a handcuff on the wall in Death Trap. It plays a crucial role in the play.
I know, she said. I watched the movie again last night. And look, on the floor.
There was a framed print, a photograph of a lighthouse that was leaning up against the wall.
You think Charlie brought the handcuffs, took down that print, and hung them up just so we'd be sure it was an homage to Death Trap?
I do, Gwen said, then turned to look toward the closet. He's hiding, probably in that closet, maybe with a mask, and then he jumps out and scares her to death.
It's strange, I said. As far as we know, it's the first time he's staged something to point specifically to the list.
It's also the first time he's killed someone that you knew.
We were both standing, looking toward the closet.
Gwen said, I've seen enough, honestly. I just want these handcuffs photographed and fingerprinted.
He probably wore gloves.
We won't know until we look, but yes, he probably wore gloves.
I looked around the rest of the room while Gwen pulled out her phone and stared at what looked like a text message she'd just received. There was an old four-poster bed, loosely made up and covered with a pink chenille bedspread. The hardwood floors had woven throw rugs on them that had faded over the years. The one at the foot of the bed was covered with fur.
Did she have a pet? I said.
I don't remember reading about one in the report, Gwen said.
I tried to remember back to when Elaine Johnson used to come in to Old Devils, and I didn't remember her ever paying attention to Nero. My guess is her sister had a dog or a cat, and she just had never cleaned the rug. In fact, nothing was clean in the house. I went and looked at a framed photograph on the wall above the bureau. The frame was white, and its top edge had turned a shiny black with all the grime. The photograph in the frame was of a family on vacation, a father in a golf shirt,
a mother in a short plaid dress and horn-rimmed glasses. There were four children, two older boys and two younger girls. They were posed in front of an enormous tree, a redwood, probably, somewhere in California. I leaned in, trying to pick out which one of the pre-adolescent girls was Elaine, but the photograph was slightly blurry and had faded with age. I assumed, however, that Elaine was the younger of the two, the one with glasses, holding a doll by her side. She was the only child not smiling. "Ready?" Gwen said.
"Sure."
When we got to the bottom of the stairs, I peered into the living room, lined with shelves. "Can I look at the books in here real quick?" I said, and Gwen shrugged and nodded. It was clear that Elaine's sister had been a reader as well, and that most of the books that filled the living room shelves had belonged to her. There was a lot of nonfiction and historical fiction. One entire shelf was devoted to James Michener, but there was also a tall bookcase crammed into a corner that looked as though it had been brought by Elaine. One of its shelves was filled with a dusty collection of vintage glass paperweights. The rest were crammed with more mystery novels arranged by author. I was surprised to see the collected works of Thomas Harris, a writer that Elaine had once told me was an overrated pervert. I was also surprised to see a copy of The Drowner until I saw that it was sitting between Strangers on a Train and a copy of Death Trap. A little shiver went through me. All the books were there, all eight from my list, in order. I brought Gwen over and her eyes went big. She took a photograph with her phone. "Do you think he brought these here himself, or were the books already here?" she said. "I think he brought them, probably. Elaine might have had all these books, but I doubt it." "Think we'll be able to tell anything from these copies?" she said. "Maybe," I said. "He bought them somewhere. Maybe from my store, or maybe from somewhere else. Usually when you buy a used book, there's a penciled price on the first page, and sometimes there's a sticker with the name of the dealer." "I don't want you to touch them, but can you tell anything by looking at the spines?" I studied them, all eight books from my list, sitting together like an accusation. The only spine that jumped out was the one for Malice Aforethought. I recognized it as a UK paperback edition released as a tie-in with a TV miniseries from about 10 years ago. It was a copy that had definitely come through the store because I remembered how much I disliked that edition. In general, I hate all tie-in book covers. I told Gwen that I thought I recognized one of the books as one I had had in the store. "Okay, good," she said. I could hear the excitement in her voice. "After I get them checked for fingerprints, I'll have them photographed and we can look at them together. Let's go check into the hotel." She'd booked us two rooms at a Hampton Inn and Suites about a mile out of Rockland's town center. It was across the street from a McDonald's, and I was worried that was where we'd end up eating dinner, but she mentioned a place she liked on Main Street. "I made reservations for two, but if you'd rather go someplace else..." "No," I said. "I'm happy to follow your lead." We checked in, then met back in the lobby an hour later and drove into town. It was off-season, so I was surprised that several restaurants seemed to be open. We parked right in front of a two-story brick building, only a few steps away from the entrance to the town tavern, advertising itself as an ale and oyster house. It was a Sunday night and the place was predictably empty, although two couples sat at the bar. The hostess, a youngish woman wearing a Bruins sweatshirt, took us to a booth. "This okay?" Gwen said.
"Sure. You said you've been here before?"
"My grandparents have a house on McGuntacook Lake, which is not far from here. I come up to the mid-coast at least 2 weeks every summer. Honestly, it's my grandpa who reveres this place because they do baked oysters the way he likes them." The waitress came. I ordered a gritty McDuff's English-style bitter and a lobster roll. Gwen ordered a harpoon and a haddock Reuben.
"No baked oysters?" I said.
She turned to the waitress. "Can we get six oysters to start?" After the waitress left, Gwen said, "For Grandpa. I'll let him know."
"Where do they live the rest of the year?" I asked.
"Upstate New York, although they keep talking about moving here year-round. But they'd have to buy a new house. The lake place isn't winterized. Have you been to this part of Maine before?"
"I've been to Camden, once. That's close to here, right?"
"Next town, yeah. When was that?"
"I don't know exactly. 10 years ago? Just a vacation." I'd gone with Claire, of course, back when we frequently took road trips all over New England. Our beers arrived, along with a basket of bread. We each took sips, then Gwen said,
"Can I ask you about your wife? Do you mind?"
"I don't mind, no," I said, and tried to look normal. But I was aware that we'd lost eye contact across the table.
"When did she die?"
5 years ago now, although it doesn't feel that long.
"I'm sure," Gwen said, wiping some foam off her upper lip with a knuckle. "That must have been terrible, her dying so young. The way she died?"
"You've done some checking up."
"Yes, a little bit. When I first got your name, when I found the list, I ran a check on you."
"Did you see that I'd been questioned in the murder investigation into Eric Atwell?"
"I did see that."
"I would have killed him, if I had a chance. But it wasn't me."
"I know that."
"It's okay if you don't. I know you're doing your job, and I know you're wondering what connection I have with all these murders. Truth is, I don't have any, or at least not that I know of. After my wife died, I told myself that I would just go on living by myself, doing my job, reading books. I want a quiet life."
"I believe you," she said, and she looked at me with an emotion I couldn't quite read. It seemed like affection, or maybe it was pity.
"You sure?"
"Well, this crime scene, Elaine Johnson's murder, does change things. It's different from the others. It's pointing directly at you, directly at the list."
"I know it is. It's giving me a very strange feeling."
"Tell me more about Brian Murray. Would he have known Elaine Johnson?"
"He did, actually," I said. "Well, I don't know if he'd spoken to her, but he definitely knew her because Brian comes to all our readings and Elaine comes as well. It used to come."
"How did the two of you end up buying the store together?"
"We were friends. Not close, but he was in the store a lot and we'd occasionally get a drink. When the previous owner decided to sell, I must have told Brian about it, about how I'd buy it if I had the money. I think he offered to come in right away. He had his lawyer write up a deal in which he provided the majority of the capital and I'd manage the business. It was a perfect arrangement. It still is."
"He doesn't have anything to do with these murders." "How do you know that?"
I sipped my beer. "He's an alcoholic, a functioning one, but barely. He writes his yearly book in about 2 months and takes the rest of the year off to drink. He's 60 years old, but looks 70, and every time we hang out together, he tells me the exact same stories. I just don't see it. Even if for some reason he had murderous intentions, there's just no way he could pull it off. He doesn't even drive. He takes taxis everywhere."
"Okay.
You believe me?"
"I'll look into him, but yes, I believe you. I used to read his books, actually, when I was a teenager. Ellis Fitzgerald was one of the reasons I wanted to go into law enforcement.
The early books were good."
"I loved them. I remember that I could read an entire book in a day."
Our oysters came, and the rest of our food shortly afterward. We didn't talk anymore about the crime scene or Brian Murray or anything remotely personal. We ate, and Gwen went over her plan for the next day. She was going to go into the local FBI office and arrange for a scene of crime officer to conduct an investigation at Elaine Johnson's house. She also wanted to talk with neighbors who might have seen a stranger or at least a strange car around the time of Elaine's death.
"I can look into a bus that will take you back to Boston," she said. Otherwise, you can come back with me, but it might not be until late in the afternoon.
I'll wait, I said. Unless you think it's going to be another night. I brought a book.
Another one from the list? She said.
I did. I brought Malice Aforethought.
After dinner, we drove back in silence to the hotel, then stood together in the harsh light of the empty lobby. Thanks for coming on this trip, she said. I realize it's probably an inconvenience.
It's actually nice, I said. Get out of the city.
Visit the scene of a murder.
Yes, I said.
We stood awkwardly for a moment. I did briefly wonder if Gwen had some romantic interest in me. I was only about 10 years older than she was, and I knew that I was not unhandsome. My hair was completely gray now, more of a silver, really, but I'd kept all of it. I was slim and had a decent jawline. My eyes were blue. I took a step backward. I felt that shimmery glass wall between us, the one that kept me from becoming close to anyone except for ghosts. She must have felt it as well, because she said goodnight. I went back to my hotel room and began to read. Chapter 16. What impressed me about Malice Aforethought back when I'd first encountered it just after college was the cold determination of the murderer. Edmund Bickley, we discover on the first page of the novel, has decided that he wants to kill his domineering, vindictive wife. He's a doctor with access to an array of drugs. Over the course of the first half of the book, he slowly turns his wife into a morphine addict. He does this by spiking her tea with a drug that gives her blinding headaches, then curing them with the opiate. Then he cuts her off from the morphine, enough so that she begins to fake his signature on prescriptions so that she can procure it herself. It becomes clear to the other residents of their country village that she is an addict. The rest is easy. One evening, he simply gives her an overdose. There's no way he can be fingered for the crime. I read most of the book that night, then finished it the following morning. It was hard to concentrate, but there were times in the novel, it's actually quite funny, that I was swept up in the story. As always, I thought back to the last time I'd read the book, how young I'd been, how differently I had reacted to the same words. When I'd first started at Red Line Bookstore in Harvard Square after my time at college, Sharon Abrams, the owner's wife, had given me a handwritten list of her favorite books, all mysteries but one. I've long since lost that list, but I have it memorized. Besides Malice Aforethought, she'd listed Gaudy Night and The Nine Tailors by Dorothy L. Sayers, The Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay, Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, the first two Sue Grafton books, The Ritual Bath by Faye Kellerman, and The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco. Even though she said she'd never finished it, I just love the beginning so much. Her other favorite book was Bleak House by Charles Dickens. I guess you could say that it has mystery elements as well. I remember being so touched by the fact that she'd written this list for me that in the space of about 2 weeks, I read everything on it, even rereading the books I was familiar with. And reading Malice Aforethought back then, I remember feeling buoyed by its grim outlook on humanity. It's satire, essentially, ripping the idea of romance to shreds. Reading the book at the Hampton Inn in Rockland, it felt more like a horror story this time. Bickley, obsessed by a life he cannot have, kills his wife in a brutal fashion, and it destroys his life. He is infected forever by the act of killing. Just before noon, Gwen texted to tell me that she'd be ready to leave Maine no later than 4. I texted back that she should take all the time she needed. I had decided to walk into town. It was a sunny day, the temperatures a little higher than they'd recently been, and I'd memorized the way into town the night before. I checked out of the hotel,
asked the front desk if they could stow my backpack for the day, then walked to Rockland's town center. I visited a small used bookstore where I bought a copy of The Hawk in the Rain by Ted Hughes. I took the book with me to the same restaurant where Gwen and I had dinner the night before and sat at the bar. I got a beer and a bowl of clam chowder that came with soft white rolls. I read the poetry and tried to empty my mind of the preoccupations of the past few days. Not only was I worried that Gwen was going to eventually zero in on my role in Eric Atwell's and Norman Chaney's deaths, but this investigation had churned up memories of Claire and of the year after her death.